History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask some questions and, more importantly, to listen intently and patiently as memories from long ago take on new life in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. Our aim is to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only do we find ourselves highly entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. In the weeks ahead, we're going to meet a survivor of the Battle of the Bulge in Colorado and one of our last links to the Battle of Okinawa, who spent most of his life as a Montana cowboy. But this week, I want to share something that just happened in Hawaii and something coming up in California that perhaps you might want to take part in. So let's start out west, where World War II began for America back on December 7th, 1941. About 6 miles west of Pearl Harbor at the Waipahu Public Library, a monument was unveiled last week that is believed to be the first of its kind. Hawaii, the first state to commission a memorial to the more than 260,000 Filipino and Filipino-American soldiers who fought in World War II. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you're going to find links to photos and video of the unveiling where 3 Filipino World War II vets were among those who witnessed the debut of 4 bronze statues depicting Filipino veterans and pointing to their contributions in the war. One of the Filipino veterans we've met on Hometown Heroes was Dr. Cipriano Ginto, who managed to escape the Bataan Death March while serving with the U.S. Army's Philippine Scouts.
It is a privilege to serve and defend my country. That is the reason why I enlisted the military, to defend the freedom of my country. It's a privilege. It's an opportunity to serve. I am proud of that. I thank God about that for giving me the opportunity, the privilege to defend the freedom of my people. That is my intention in serving my country. During that war in Bataan, I was assigned in the first aid medical station. I was assigned to be a litter bearer to get all our, to collect all our casualties in the firing line. We used the litter to collect all those injured, all those casualties. It's really hard. Most of our caregivers there were shot, you know, were killed. And I'm thankful that I survived and to collect the casualties of our troops. Yeah, so we have our doctors. We are nurses behind the battlefield where we collect all the casualties. And they were given a first aid treatment there. So I'm proud to save their lives. We were pushed to the Bataan Peninsula. All military, U.S. Army, everything, they are all in Bataan. Until the time we, from January to April, fierce fighting. So we have a lot of casualties, and the Japanese have a lot of casualties too. But unfortunately, we were, you know, under. We have no more airplanes. We have no more bombs. Japanese have that, so we were forced to surrender April 1942. And then all the soldiers were taken prisoners. That is the time when they started the death march from Bataan to Camp O'Donnell. It's about 30 miles walk. That is the death march. Thousands and thousands of Filipinos and Americans walked through that death march. But in my case, we, our commander, Captain Jackson, told us, you are here from the Philippines. If you can, if you have time to escape from the death march, you can do it. So I formed my group. I was in charge of that group. And then I told them, let us go and escape, live or die among our members of my group. I formed that group to escape the death march. So we escaped the mountains for weeks. We escaped the death march. Thank God that we were able to survive that escape in the mountains until we reached the down the ocean, until we hired those people across Manila Bay. We waited till the march is ended. When the march, at the end of the march, then we tried to escape to the ocean. We crossed the street where the march was by.
Yeah.
We crossed that street at the end of the march. When we see that it's already clear and no more Japanese soldiers there, one by one, run from the mountain to the ocean. God. One by one. We don't run all together. We are eight. One, you go. I said, you go. Then they run up to the ocean. No soldier. Then I watch carefully whether there are some Japanese soldiers, you know. Then I told them, oh, you next, run. One by one. Until I was the last one to run, to meet them in the seashore. So that's the way we escaped.
I'm just imagining myself in your shoes. If I were there, I would have been pretty nervous or pretty scared running across that road. You've seen all your friends make it, but you're the last one. Was that a scary feeling to go out there and make that run? Were you nervous or scared or looking around everywhere?
Oh, yes, of course we are scared. You know, we are nervous. We are all sick, very weak. You know, 1 week escaping, we are so weak, you know. Yeah, I thought I cannot survive those moments.
Do you ever think about all the Filipinos and the Americans who died during the war and especially on the march? Do you ever think about those who didn't make it?
Oh, lots of Filipinos, my relatives, my friends, yeah, who have died during those days. Up to now, they are still in my heart. My cousins, my uncles, all my friends, they died in the concentration camp. Up to now, they are in my mind, you know. I worried about that. At night, sometimes I think of them.
And I thought of Dr. Sip Ginto and other Filipino veterans of World War II we've had the privilege of meeting when I saw the footage of that new monument being unveiled in Honolulu. Again, you can learn more about that online at hometownheroesradio.com. I'm going to make it a point to stop there the next time I'm on the island of Oahu, and maybe you should too. Again, it's at the Waipahu Public Library there. And speaking of things to do, how'd you like to play golf with a 101-year-old World War II veteran? That opportunity is going to come your way next month in Madera, California, with a fundraiser for one of my favorite places, Castle Air Museum, at the former Castle Air Force Base. Ralph Graham of Waco, Texas, has done this a couple times now, flown out to the decommissioned air base to honor its namesake general, Fred Castle, who was killed in action in the skies over Europe on Christmas Eve, 1944. Ralph Graham has a special connection to that mission that cost Castle his life, but also earned him the Medal of Honor. Graham, who turns 101 next month, has written about his connection to that mission in his book, 12 Minutes, The Untold Story of the Ghost Plane at the Battle of the Bulge. We'll hear more about that, but it always puts things in better perspective when we start at the beginning, which for Ralph came in a little place called Athens, Texas.
Athens is about 75 miles southeast of Dallas. And what I remember more about my childhood was we lived on a farm. My father raised cotton and corn and, you know, and everything you could think about. And he taught me to had a plow, and I remember I was 9 years old, and he finally turned it over to me, a plow, and by myself with a Georgia stock and one horse pulling it. And he let me plow out the meadows, you know, and all of that. And it went on from that until I grew up, and then I got to hating it.
It's exciting for a while. Right,
but we did a lot of work, and he was a wonderful farmer. He grew everything. We'd have everything. During the Depression, we had everything he'd raised. We even had a peach orchard. And I remember during all those hard times that people would come there to get milk and peaches and potatoes and Irish potatoes and canned meat. What he just did, we had so much of it, and he didn't want people to suffer, so he would just give it away.
Wow.
And that was our neighbors, you know, had nothing but a house to live in. It's pretty rough times, you know. And, of course, I remember starting to school, and I remember we had sometimes had to walk 2 miles or three to get to school. That was before we had buses, you know, to pick us up. That was as I grew up in the, you know, ready for high school,
mm-hmm.
5, 6, 7 years. And finally, I went. I graduated as a ninth grader, you know, and they sent me on to high school. And we only had 3 grades then. It had 9th, 10th, and 11th. That was it. You didn't go to the 12th. I remember all that, and then all the associates, you know, and my old classmates.
Do you remember as a boy having some ambition of, hey, when I grow up someday, this is what I'm going to do with my life?
Well, I knew I wanted to do something. But I didn't, you know, at that time, you didn't, you know, there wasn't much, there wasn't much future to look to because it was hard, it was bad, you know, during the Depression. But I did want to, I really wanted to be an engineer. But when we enlisted, they asked you what you wanted to do, and I told them, you know, I'd like to be in that park where we built bridges and things like that. And that's where they put me, and that's where I served for about 16 months, all my time there. From that, there was a bulletin that came out that said, if you'd like to try out as an aviation cadet, you can go down and take the test. And I did, and I barely passed. But anyway, a classmate and mine went down, and we tried, and both of us did. And I went on through. I don't want to get into that too much if you don't think so about the training.
Whatever you think is relevant, but okay. I am interested on the timing. So when you went from the regular Army to the aviation program, was that before or after Pearl Harbor?
That was after. That's the reason they sent this bit, the bulletin out, because they needed airmen, you know, if it could pass.
Right. So tell me about, though, December 7th. Where were you, and how did you find out what happened?
December 7th, I was, of course, still in the engineers, and we was walking down the street, been down to the recreation room, and we got back up to the door where you go in the barracks, and somebody hollered out, says, the Japanese had hit Pearl Harbor. Well, I didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was, you know. I hadn't been in the Army, you know, that long enough to know that. But anyway, that was my first time I knew that was in war.
And where was that? Where were you?
That was in San Antonio, the 2nd Infantry Division, and the 2nd Engineers was part of it. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's where I was. We came up from boot camp up to it.
And did you see things changing a lot after Pearl Harbor?
Oh, you bet. I think we're about 350,000 people in the services then, and we watched it grow and just tumble. It's just thousands after thousands that came in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason they wanted to pick out somebody that had, I did have a high school education, you know, had to do that to qualify to train. Well, anyway, I trained for, went through primary and then basic.
You're thinking you're going to be a pilot.
I learned to fly.
Mm-hmm.
But something happened, it really happened in primary. I felt something, you know, in doing aerobatics like spins and loops and all that, where the strain was on you. I felt pressure in my lower part of my body. Well, I made it all right in that plane, but when we went to basic, well, when we went from 165 horsepower to 450.
Was that from a Stearman to a BT-13 or something?
That's what it was. Yeah. The old thing vibrator, called it.
So it's a big difference in power.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that showed up bad. So I went to the doctor and told him I was having trouble. He said, well, the only thing he could do was operate. So I went back and I tried again, you know, to see if I could make it through. And I blacked out. And I went on back and told him, let's operate. I wanted to finish so bad. I said, go ahead and operate. And he did, but it didn't help. You can't fly a plane with that, you know. So I told him I didn't want to go on paperwork until that cured out. I wanted to go on so they sent me on to radio school.
How disappointing was that for you at the time?
It was bad, because I wanted to be an officer, you know.
Yeah.
But that was all right, you know, I didn't want somebody to give me something. So I went on to radio school, finished that, and then the gunnery school, finished that, and they put a recruiters up. We went through, you know, the basic part of a team working together. Of course, from there in, it was up through the northern part. We flew over and carried a bomb bay full of GI mail. We left one night about sundown and got about halfway, and they turned us back on account of that weather closed in Iceland. So we came back and waited a few days longer, and it cleared up, and this time we made it. A bunch of kids.
I was going to say, was that a little nerve-wracking for you? You'd never been through anything like that before.
Flying across, you know, 1,500 miles of water. Well, the pilot did kind of, he became a little worried every once in a while. He said, call the navigator and say, how we doing? Well, we're on course. That's about all he knew. And I did. I called him once and told him the radio traffic was sounding louder, you know, and he said, that's some relief. And so, of course, navigator was right. We went right on money. That was really the last part of the war, because we didn't go over till October of 1944. And all this stuff that I wrote about the book, that happened Christmas Eve of 1944. So, but we still training all times. Some of the crews have been there and did that. They kept us out, you know, and what we should have looked forward to, you know, prepared us for the mission, you know.
Were you a little anxious before your first mission?
You know, I wasn't. We went to Ham. Ham, Germany, that was the shortest mission over there, and I guess they did that on purpose. But, of course, we didn't have enough sense to be scared, you know. But we finally picked it up, you know, that it was dangerous.
Well, I'm always curious, too, because, you know, you've been looking at it in hindsight for most of your life now.
Right.
But before that, I mean, even before you're going overseas, some guys have told me, you know, I was invincible. Nothing was ever going to happen. Other guys have said, hey, I knew it could be me at any moment. Did it weigh on you at all, the possibility that you could be killed over there?
Well, sure, everybody had fright. But one of the things that helped us most was those 16 months that I spent in the regular Army.
Mm-hmm.
When we were trained, like, they made men out of boys, so to speak, you know. We'd go on marches and march all night long and then rest, and several times the rain would be pouring down. And we'd lay down on the ground, and the rain wouldn't even bother us. We'd sleep 30, 40 minutes, and up going again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that. And then went to Louisiana for maneuvers, and it's the same old story. You lay there in a pup tent, and it rained that night, and you'd have water marks on your legs. But, you know, things like that toughens you up, and you learn to give and take, you know, and say, well, this is going to happen. Yeah, I better do this. So It really did help, because I could tell some of the younger people that didn't do that went directly into the Air Force.
So it sounds like you're saying that time in the Army helped you understand that you could handle and endure more than you maybe thought.
You're still frightened, scared, of course, especially on different situations. But overall, it really helped. It sure did.
And I guess another, you know, thought that comes to mind, if you hadn't volunteered for aviation cadet training, you might have been one of those guys on the ground at the Battle of the Bulge.
Incidentally, they were. The second engineers is one that the Germans was running over. The fog was so heavy that even they didn't know what they were hitting.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the guys said that we lost some of the people that I soldiered with. The tanks would run over them. Because, like I say, the Germans couldn't. It was a mess, you know. The book will tell about that. But that's actually what it was.
So you don't have to speculate or wonder. You know where your unit was and what happened to it.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come. If you'd like to sign up for next month's golf tournament, where you can swing your clubs right next to that guy you're listening to, soon-to-be 101-year-old Ralph Graham, you can find all that information at hometownheroesradio.com. It's coming up next month on Saturday, April 22nd, at Madera Golf and Country Club in Madera, California, with all the proceeds going to support the preservation of historic aircraft at the amazing Castle Air Museum in Atwater, California. There is so much to see there, and there's so much more to hear here. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.